Chapter 10 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 10. Lionel Johnson, as I say, called for me one day during the vacation at my mother's house, 18 Cadogan Place, and took me on to see Oscar Wilde in Tite Street. We had tea in his little writing room, facing the street on the ground floor, and before I left, Oscar took me upstairs to the drawing room and introduced me to his wife. I was always on the best of terms with Mrs. Wilde. I liked her and she liked me. She told me, about a year after I first met her, that she liked me better than any of Oscar's other friends. She frequently came to my mother's house and was present at a dance which my mother gave during the first year of my acquaintance with her husband. After the debacle, I never saw her again, and I do not doubt that Ross and others succeeded in poisoning her mind against me. But up to the very last day of our acquaintance, we were the best of friends. The last time I saw her was 2 nights before the proceedings taken by Oscar Wilde against my father at the Old Bailey, when we all three had dinner in a restaurant and went on to a box at the St. James's Theatre, where Oscar's play, The Importance of Being Earnest, was running to crowded houses. She was very much agitated, and when I said good night to her at the door of the theatre, she had tears in her eyes. I felt dreadfully sorry for her, for though I then believed that Oscar would beat my father, and had not the slightest anticipation of the frightful catastrophe that was imminent, I knew that at the very best the whole business must be a terrible ordeal for her. Honesty compels me to say that Oscar, during the time I knew him, was not very kind to his wife. He certainly had been, as he often told me, very much in love with her, and the marriage was purely a love match. At the time when I first met him, he was still fond of her, but he was often impatient with her, and sometimes snubbed her, and he resented, and showed that he resented, the attitude of slight disapproval which she often adopted towards him. Towards the end of the time before the catastrophe, and they never met again after he came out of prison, the relations between them were distinctly strained. To try to make out that this had anything whatever to do with me is simply dishonest and untruthful. Those who know the facts, and there are many now living who do know them, will, if they tell the truth, bear witness that I was never a bone of contention between Oscar and his wife, although I once used that very phrase in a jocular way in a letter to Ross, which was used against me at the ransom trial. The evidence as to the sort of thing Oscar was doing, and the kind of people he met and associated with, which came out at his trial, is surely enough to account for the by no means complete estrangement that had arisen between his wife and himself, without trying to drag me into it. The real truth is, as Harris and Ross and the rest of my detractors always knew perfectly well, that if Oscar had confined himself to his extravagant devotion to me, even admitting, as I do, that there was, for a time, an element of perverseness about it, he could have laughed at all his enemies, not excepting my father. The letters he wrote me, which were used by my father, not, as was expressly and carefully explained by Sir Edward Carson to the jury at the Old Bailey, with any idea of suggesting that there had been anything actually wrong between us, but as a father's justification for his action in intervening to end a dangerous friendship, have been printed over and over again in the newspapers. There were only 2 of them. Anyone can read them for himself, and I will defy anyone to say that they contain any evidence whatsoever of misconduct. They proved, what neither Wilde nor I ever denied, that Wilde had an exaggerated devotion to me, and an unbounded admiration for my personal appearance. He compared me to Hylas and Hyacinthus, and the language he used was, of course, extravagant and unusual. But there is nothing whatever in his letters which could not be matched in Shakespeare's sonnets, also written to a boy. And though I believe it is the fashion nowadays to accuse Shakespeare of having had the same vices as Wilde, This merely shows the ignorance and baseness and stupidity of those who make such accusations on such grounds. Shakespeare, as I have pointed out before, refuted his detractors by anticipation in the last six lines of the very sonnet which is generally quoted as the strongest evidence against him. I refer to the sonnet beginning, "A woman's face with nature's own hand painted, hast thou, the master mistress of my passion." The lines enumerated above clearly show not only that Shakespeare's passion for Mr. W.H. was perfectly innocent, but that Shakespeare himself had never envisaged the possibility of its being anything else. "Nature," says he, "who intended thee for a woman, fell a-doting, and, by addition, thee of me defeated." Could anything be clearer? "If you had been a woman, but unfortunately you were a boy, so that I was defeated." To rub it in still more strongly, he goes on to say, "But since she pricked thee out for woman's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure." The effect of the lines referred to is even stronger, because they are so obviously not deliberately made in answer to, or in anticipation of, any adverse suggestion. Shakespeare exculpates himself, in the eyes of any reasonable being, quite definitely and quite unconsciously. Obviously it never occurred to him that anyone would put a bad interpretation on his love and adoration for Master W.H. In the same way, I repeat, I will challenge anyone who is not prejudiced to find anything in any letter of Wilde's to me that exists, or ever has existed, that is not consistent with a perfectly pure devotion. The two letters produced by my father were the two worst, from Wilde's point of view, and from mine, chiefly because they were artificial, and therefore not moving. But there is really nothing wrong or incriminating in them. If Wilde had not been proved up to the hilt to have been what he was, on the evidence of a whole troop of male gutter snipes, for frequenting whose society he could not produce any other possible explanation, he would certainly have been in no danger from anything connected with his friendship with me. The gentle Harris and others, who are so ready, for reasons best known to themselves, to fling at me the accusation of having ruined Wilde and sacrificed him to gratify my hatred of my father, overlook the fact that the numerous boys in respect of whom he was accused and convicted, one and all became his accusers. It was they that gave him away, and gave evidence against him in the witness box. All I did was to stick to him through thick and thin, and to offer, and indeed beg to be allowed, to go into the witness box to defend him. While I am on the subject of the two letters of Wilde's to me, produced by my father, and brought up against me several times since, without causing me to turn a hair, I may give an example of the methods which commend themselves to Mr. Frank Harris in what he wishes us to believe is a noble and disinterested effort to defend the memory of his friend. One of the letters to which I have just referred contains the following words: "I am sure Hyacinthus, whom Apollo loved so madly, was you in Greek days." This is what Mr. Harris thinks it fair to the memory of his dead friend to turn the words into, in his book, The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde. "No Apollo followed love so madly as you in Greek days." In his anxiety to get in a foul blow at me, he deliberately makes out his beloved friend to be the author of the vile phrase quoted, concerning which it might well be said that Oscar Wilde would turn in his grave if he knew that he had been accused of writing such an appalling and disgusting vulgarism. If, as I say, there was nothing whatever in Wilde's letters to me which could have caused him the slightest serious trouble, it is equally true that there was not, and never has been, any other serious evidence against us. Harris, in his new preface to The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, refers to my relations with Wilde in the following words: Little can be laid to the charge of Douglas in his relations with Wilde, but intense admiration for an older and very brilliant man, and for having permitted, against the grain, such familiarities as are common among boyfriends at English public schools. The graver accusation was simply invented from beginning to end. Quite so. Invented by Frank Harris. No one else has ever made the accusation. Harris wrote the words quoted above after I had, of my own free will, told him exactly and in detail what my relations with Wilde were for a comparatively short period of time. There was nothing whatever to make me confess to him to the extent I did, except a regard for truth. If I had sworn that there never had been even what there was, for a short time, in our relations, Harris would not have had it in his power to produce a tittle of evidence to the contrary. As a matter of fact, no such suggestion, even to the extent of imputing what I have voluntarily confessed, was made against me, either at the trial of my father, when the suggestion was formally repudiated by my father's counsel, Carson, or later at Wilde's trials. Apart from malicious and lying gossip, no such charge has ever been made against me in such a way that I could take steps to refute it. Harris, in his book, invents a deliberately lying account of my first meeting with Wilde. Remembering that Lionel Johnson was present at this meeting, and that Mrs. Wilde was in the next room, it does not require any more than the most elementary common sense for anyone to decide that Mr. Harris's story is a wicked, malicious, and grotesquely preposterous lie. How could Harris possibly know what took place, or what was said, at my first interview with Wilde? He does not, in his book, pretend that his information came from Wilde, and the only two other persons who could know were myself and Lionel Johnson. What really happened, of course, at that interview was just the ordinary interchange of courtesies. Wilde was very agreeable and talked a great deal. I was very much impressed, much more so than I have admitted in my book, Oscar Wilde and Myself, which I wrote with Crossland. And, before I left, Wilde had asked me to lunch or to dinner at his club, and I had accepted his invitation. Of course, if Harris's book, The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, had been published in England, I would long ago have taken criminal proceedings against Harris and his publisher, and he would, without the shadow of doubt, have been sent to prison, probably for the maximum 2 years. But as the book was published in America by Harris himself, without a publisher, I was powerless to do anything. Want of money prevented me from going to America, and even if I had gone there, what chance would I have had of obtaining in that country the justice which I have only barely succeeded in obtaining in my own country after a long and bitter fight against frightful odds? End of chapter 10.